Hello, and welcome to the BBC History Magazine weekly podcast. I'm Rob Attar, Deputy Editor of the magazine. This is the third of our March 2012 podcasts. Don't forget, BBC History Magazine is on sale in all good newsagents and also on subscription. Visit our website, historyextra.com, for more information. Or you can follow us at twitter.com/historyextra or facebook.com/historyextra. BBC History Magazine is also now available for the Kindle. You can search for us on Amazon or find out more at historyextra.com/Kindle. Coming up in this week's episode.
And one of the things that you have to bear in mind when you're visiting any Tudor site, in inverted commas, is that it has lived through all those centuries since.
That was Susanna Lipscomb talking Tudors at the Vine in Hampshire.
There was one report in an 18th century newspaper that 26 butchers and their wives had slept in the bed for a wager. I think that's pushing it slightly.
And that was Kate Hay on the curious story of the Great Bed of Ware. For our first interview, the magazine's editor, Dave Musgrove, has been on location to the Vine, a National Trust property near Basingstoke in Hampshire. He invited the Tudor specialist, Susanna Lipscomb, to join him, because she's just written a book called A Visitor's Companion to Tudor England. She's also written a piece for the March issue of BBC History magazine on the court of Henry VIII and places to visit associated with that. The Vine was home to one of King Henry's leading courtiers, Lord William Sandys. Dave asked Susanna to guide him around the house, pointing out the Tudor highlights and telling him about the life of a Tudor courtier to the king. And if this whets your appetite for the Vine, you'll also find a slideshow on our website at historyextra.com/vine.
Okay, so we're here in the Vine near Basingstoke, a historic house, and we're going to be talking Tudor. So the first thing we need to do is describe where we are. So Susanna, what sort of things can you see here?
Well, we're in the long gallery, which is, as it sounds, like a long room, and it has floor-to-ceiling linen fold panelling. So that's oak panelling that's carved to look like the folds of a cloth, linen. And what's distinct about this long gallery is that these panels are beautifully carved with signs of heraldry, coats of arms and devices of all the people that the person who built this house knew in the 1520s. So it has this incredible quality of being a kind of visual who's who of Tudor England. Everybody that William Lord Sandys, who was the builder, knew is represented on the walls here.
Okay, so let's talk about the house itself, because obviously this is just one room of the house. So did Sandys build it, or did he develop it from something that was already here?
There were a few medieval buildings here, but really Sandys made this house. He created a very large house. What we have now is a very small version of the original. Sandys was a courtier under Henry VII and under Henry VIII, and it's under Henry VIII that he really rose. He became Knight of the Garter, he was created a baron, and he was given a position at court that he had great authority. So that he also had a lot of money, and he came to the Vine to build himself a house that reflected that wealth and status. And this room is one of many rooms that did that by displaying his connections and his wealthy associates.
Okay, so is this room the very peak of Tudor showing off, or would you actually get more showy rooms than this?
This is pretty good for early Tudor period. This is very rare that there's a long gallery in the early Tudor period. The Elizabethans build loads of them. Henry VIII builds one at Nonsuch Palace in the late 1530s. But for Sandys to have built this earlier in the 16th century, in the 1520s, was remarkable in and of itself to build a room of this size, and then to decorate it with these emblems. It really is a testament to his position.
Yeah, because in terms of size, it's, what is it, about 40 metres, maybe, something like that? It's certainly a long space, isn't it? And maybe 4 or 5 metres across, so it's a very narrow, long room, which is why it's called a long gallery.
Yes, it's a perfect place for getting exercise when it's either raining outside and you don't want to go out there, or when it's sunny and you don't want to go out and get a tan. So you can walk up and down here, and people who were visiting him could admire all these people that he knew and could display them on his walls. So it's really ostentatious.
So is it actually like an early gymnasium? It was for exercise purposes.
It is exactly that. It's for exercise, much more sedate than perhaps in a modern gym, but yep. For walking, for playing ball, that sort of thing, bowls, was entirely possible in a space like this.
Okay, so let's have a wander around and see some of the features that are here, because as you said, the panelling is quite amazing, isn't it? Certainly in terms of its age and its survival, it's fantastic that it's still here. And as you said, it's floor to ceiling wooden panelling. So what sort of things can we see here?
Well, what we see actually is panelling that has survived intact from the Tudor period. It has been painted since. It was painted in the 1840s, which is why it has this slightly sort of darker quality to it. But we can see engravings. So, for example, over here we've got the pomegranate, which is one of the symbols of Catherine of Aragon, the symbol of Granada. And at the top of that panel, there's a carving of a castle, which was the symbol of Castile. So that panel is all about Catherine of Aragon and the fact that Sands knew her and could feel a personal association with her.
Would people have recognised that, or would you have had to have stood in front of it and said, look, I know Catherine of Aragon, I'm saying this?
People would have recognised it, absolutely. People could read heraldry in a way that we can read brand logos, like a Nike symbol, you know what that is. And they knew it of people's heraldry. So I think they thought perhaps a lot, well, as visually as we do, because many people weren't literate. And so these little associations absolutely worked for them.
Mm-hmm. And so the expectation was that visitors, guests would come here and they would be standing around waiting for drinks to be served or whatever, and they would be looking at the panels and getting a feel of how important their host was.
Exactly right, yes. And for those who could read, some of them have initials on or mottos. So, for example, up here we've got one for William Sands himself, WS. Mm. And then at the top we have one of his crests. I think that's the winged half-goat, which is one of the ones that he had. Mm. So we've got sort of four layers of panels here, so some of them you really have to crane your neck up to see. And others are of Henry VIII himself, so there are fleur-de-lis here, there are Tudor roses, mm-hmm. And actually one of the sweetest ones is the Tudor rose and the pomegranate, which grow together on one stem.
And what's that depicting?
Which depicts Henry VIII and his wife, Catherine of Aragon. So it's one of the things that dates this room. And we can date it through dendrochronology, through counting the tree rings, the age of the wood, but also through who's depicted here. So Catherine of Aragon is here, and Thomas Wolsey is here. Mm. So that means it has to have been created at some point between 1515 and 1529. Ah, here's one of the finest. Have a look at this one. That's the cardinal's hat of Thomas Wolsey.
Oh.
So you've got these things that can be read very clearly to say who Sands associates with. And the funny thing is, for us today, to do this to a room, it looks somewhat sycophantic. Because you know they're going to come and visit, so you put up the sort of bishop's mitre, or you put up, the cardinal's hat. But for the Tudor period, they loved that sort of thing. So later, under Elizabeth, courtiers would end up building their houses in the shape of E's for her initial. And actually, even earlier in the reign, it was considered quite normal to represent your patrons and your associates in this way.
Mm. So did Sands run into trouble in later years then for some of the depictions, for some of the emblems that he put up here? Because obviously they fell out of favour as the years went on.
Funnily enough, he didn't. Sands is one of the lucky men, or perhaps one might say canny men, who managed to survive Henry VIII's court with his head intact. He really knew how to do what a Tudor courtier needed to do, which was to bend like a reed in the wind. So he has this amazing rise. He is known under Henry VII, particularly gets to know Henry VII through his wife, Marjorie Bray, and he's given positions of authority. He's asked to take Margaret, who's Henry VII's daughter, up to Scotland to marry James IV. Mm-hmm. And Henry VIII gets him to do a very similar task and take his younger sister, Mary, to France to marry Louis XII. So Sands is obviously seen as a safe pair of hands, and he's given these positions of authority. And one of the things I love about Sands is that he is a bit like a Tudor flashman. He appears at all these important occasions at Tudor events. So he is, for example, at Anne Boleyn's coronation, and he's there again as a juror at her trial. He's at Edward VI's baptism, and then he's a couple of weeks later at the funeral of Jane Seymour. He's there to try the Exeter conspirators in the late 1530s. So he really has a front seat to history at this period of time. But he has that because he's willing to do what it takes. So he depicts Catherine of Aragon on the panels here, but he's willing to go to Anne Boleyn's coronation, unlike someone like Thomas More.
Okay, so he was flexible in his approach, very sensible. But so he didn't have to come back here and have his master carver, you know, come and excise people's emblems when things went wrong for them.
It's a good question, because of course at Hampton Court that's exactly what happened. All the symbols of Catherine of Aragon and then Anne Boleyn following her were knocked out at various times and replaced with the badges of the next queen. But no, Sands never does that. And that's really interesting also because Henry VIII visits him here on three occasions, one a year after his coronation, but then again in the 1530s, 1531 and 1535. And you'd think by that point it might have been slightly uncomfortable for Henry to have Catherine of Aragon displayed so obviously on the walls and, as we'll see, on the stained glass downstairs. But obviously he doesn't mind so much that Sands has to do anything about it.
No, okay. So Henry came here, and do we know what he did here at the Vine? What went on?
I should imagine that Henry did what he did when he went to visit anywhere. He went hunting because he loved to do that. And we're surrounded still now by beautiful countryside, perfect place to go for a ride.
Yeah, okay. And let's talk a bit about the court, because that's part of the reason why we're here. So Sands was as you said, one of the favoured courtiers of Henry VIII. So we need to understand how the Tudor court worked. What was the underlying basis for the court?
The court was, by definition, anywhere within about 12 miles of where the king was.
Right.
It's what was literally attendant on the king. It's made up of three parts: the royal household, the privy chamber, and the privy council. And at any one time, that can add up to about 1,000 people who are surrounding the king and attending to his needs. It's the heart of power. It's the seat of government. It's the centre of culture. It's the centre of fashion, of learning, of literature. And it's the place to get anything done. So if you want to achieve anything in the Tudor period, if you want honour or glory or fame or just to do something worthwhile and to achieve your political goals, you have to go to court.
Okay, so Sands, you know, because he was a man of stature and wanted to make something of himself, he had to be attendant on Henry.
Exactly.
Okay, so when Henry came here, can we assume that he would have come with his huge retinue, or did he sort of thin down a bit as he progressed around the country?
He would have thinned down a bit, but he would still be travelling in some style. There would have been, we don't know the exact numbers for when he came to visit Sands here, but at other times we've records of him travelling with about 100 or so people when he was on progress. So it's still quite a lot of people that Sands has to accommodate. But he's lucky. His house is almost the size of Hampton Court. He can accommodate that many people. Now it's much smaller because in the mid-17th century, when it was bought by Challoner Chute, it was reduced significantly and made to its current size.
Okay, so we're lucky that this room survives then, I presume. I mean, how often do rooms like this survive? It's fairly rare, isn't it?
Well, there are a significant number of them, but you're absolutely right that later generations have different fashions and quite often get rid of them. And many of the rooms at the Vine aren't 16th century. They have been replaced with 18th century furnishings, completely done up. So that explains also the classical portico on the front of the building. So we are very lucky to have this room.
Because often long galleries, they sort of survive, but they've been divided up, so you can't really get the sense of them in other major houses. Fashions have led to smaller rooms, so you can't quite see the extent of them as you can here.
Exactly. At Burley House, for example, that's become several rooms, the George's rooms, rather than seeing the full length of the long gallery that Burley intended there.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, we've got this bust of Henry VIII here, which, as you were saying, is probably a later example, but it's good to stand in front of Henry and think about the way he structured his country and the way he ran his country. So you were saying that the court was, you know, was where it all happened. Would there be much business done when he was out and about around the country? Did you know, the business carry on even when he was away from London and his main palaces.
Yes, it did. The court followed him around, and the Privy Council met nearly every day. Now, Henry didn't have to be at that council. In fact, most of the time he wasn't. But if it wasn't actually with him, they would be sending messages to him, and quite a lot of the time it did travel with him to his various palaces. It is quite something, isn't it, to be in front of this bust of Henry VIII and think that Henry himself actually walked up and down this long gallery that we're standing in now.
I mean, that's an interesting thought, actually. He was a big man, wasn't he, Henry, in his later years? So it's not that wide a room. If you'd been stood here as well, he would have been brushing shoulders with him. So, I mean, but presumably, if Henry had been in the room, then everyone else would have been out, or would there have been a crowd of people around him in this room?
Henry was always surrounded by people. Henry was very rarely alone. We shouldn't think of him having any sort of sense of privacy that we have in the modern sense. And you're right, he was big. He was almost 6'2" at the time when the average height for men was 5'7.5". So, I mean, that's tall by today's standards, but it was very, very tall back then. And what's interesting is he came here at various stages in his life. So he came here soon after his coronation when he is 18, 19 years old. And at that stage, reputed to be one of the best-looking men in Christendom, and athletic and energetic and charismatic. And then in the 1530s, where he's still a fine figure of a man, slightly bigger. His waist has gone from 32 to 37 inches. He's a bit more like a rugby player by that point. But, you know, he hasn't quite entered his period of descent. So the figure we need to think of when we're thinking about the vine is the youthful Henry rather than the Henry of his last decade and his obesity.
And what do we know about Sands? You said he was a flashman type figure. Do we actually know much about his personality? Have we been able to glean anything about that?
We don't know that much about him. I actually think he's a perfect subject for some historical novelist to write about because he has this wonderful position where he appears all the time, popping up at places. But of his actual character, we don't know that much, except that, as we know, he was willing to bend and be flexible when the occasion called for it.
Okay, well, I'm sure there's some budding historical novelists listening to this, so there's a tip. Just thinking about the room itself. Obviously, there's a lot of stuff here that's clearly later than the Tudor period. There's some Rococo tables and such like. There's a large modern scaffold because they're doing some conservation work, and there's some huge portraits. The question that springs to mind to me is how far can we evoke what it would have been in the early 16th century? How different do you think it would have been? What sort of things would have been here that aren't today?
You're absolutely right. A lot of the things that we can see in the Rococo tables and obviously the scaffolding wouldn't have been here. And a lot of these were brought back later, trips to the, you know, grand tours, and they're displayed here as objects of wealth from a much later period. And one of the things that you have to bear in mind when you're visiting any Tudor site, in inverted commas, is that it has lived through all those centuries since. And it's an accident of history when things have remained the same, because later generations didn't have the same attitude to conservation that we had. The example I always think of is that Nonsuch Palace was given to Barbara Villiers, one of Charles II's mistresses or former mistress, and then demolishes it and sells it off in parts to pay off her gambling debts. So they didn't have the same attitude to conservation, and quite frankly, they didn't often like what they saw. So when William and Mary went to Hampton Court at the end of the 17th century, they thought it was gloomy and dark and old-fashioned, and they wanted to knock it down and build a new palace. You have to realise that they didn't care for it in the same way. And so when we have something like this, which is a room which, at least in its interior decoration, if not in the objects then put in it, is essentially as it would have been in the 16th century, it's a very special place indeed.
I mean, your book is entitled The Visitor's Guide to Tudor England, so what would you suggest when people are visiting these properties? What sort of things should they look out for? How should they try and read the places they visit?
One of the things I've tried to do in the book is to provide a guide to do exactly that, how to strip away all the things that have accrued in the intervening centuries and take you back to see what the Tudors would have seen when they were at these houses, whether it's the panelling or the covering on the floor or the fireplaces or whatever it is, the plasterwork ceilings that would have been there. And to point out what wouldn't have been there as well, so that you can take that out and try and imagine these rooms as they would have been lived in. I feel there's a really important sense when you visit places about the tangibility of the past. Someone said to me that when you visit these places, it's only time and not space that separates you from these great characters of the past. And I find that to be really true. I think that you can have a sense of evoking, so this is the place where they might have thought about this, or they must have made that decision, or this is where they were at that stage in their lives. And it brings it all to life much more.
That's an appealing sentiment, isn't it? So when you're looking at these properties, what would you say is characteristically Tudor? What are the things that someone wandering around ought to have his or her eyes peeled for? I mean, wooden panelling like this obviously is a good example. Any other really obvious things that you can say, you can say to your wife or your husband, that's Tudor, you know?
Well, there's a whole different range of different things. So at the bottom end of the spectrum, you've got the country, sort of chocolate box cottage that we think of as being Tudor. So that black and white scheme, by the way, is generally Victorian. But you've got the wattle and daub, so you have something that would have been timber frames infilled with a mixture of hay and dung and all sorts of things like that. So that's the basic house, and the smallest possible house in Tudor period was made with a frame of one, called a crook frame, of a tree split in half that bends in the middle to form an A shape. So that's the basic house. And then you've got elaborations on that theme with places like Little Morton Hall or Goresworth Hall in Cheshire. Beautiful black and white houses which have intricate designs. Look out on the whole for small windows. The Tudors, towards the end of the period, are getting into rooms with a view, but earlier on it's small windows because they could afford panes of glass in small pieces.
Sure.
Look out for the linen fold panelling. Look out for brick chimneys, often very finely decorated, earlier in the period. So Framlingham Castle has incongruous Tudor chimneys, or Ludlow Castle has beautiful carved Tudor chimneys, and Thornbury Castle has some amazing ones. Fortunately, the ones at Hampton Court are all from the Victorian period. Sorry about that. But then later in the period, it all changes. So under Elizabeth, then you need to look out for the prodigy houses, which are great houses of glass. So Hardwick Hall, we've mentioned, has those acres of glass. More
glass than wall, isn't it? Exactly.
So, and the same is true of somewhere like Montacute. So you're looking for houses built out of the local stone, often that sort of beautiful, tawny-coloured stone, acres of glass, and then bigger rooms. The other thing to look out for early in the period is a great hall, a baron's hall, which is a medieval hangover, and then as the century goes on, look out more for things like long galleries.
Okay, so all sorts of interesting things to look out for. I like the chimneys. Chimneys are good fun. The Framlingham chimneys are fantastic, aren't they? It's a very strange, like a medieval castle with these exotic chimneys, you know, towering away. It's a fantastic place for this. Okay, so I think we've sort of covered the basics of the story here. So I think what we should do is have a wander and see what else we can find in the Vine.
Okay.
Right, so we've come downstairs. Now we're directly below the Oak Gallery, and we're in what I believe they call the Stone Gallery.
That's right.
I can see the reason why.
Yes, and actually over there we've got all sorts of bits of pieces that were dredged out of the lake, which are from the original Tudor house that was sort of thrown away when it was, parts of it were demolished in the 17th century.
Okay, we're standing in front of the fireplace.
Yes, and above the fireplace we've got this incredible terracotta roundel. So it's a head of a Roman emperor, sort of classical bust, that's set in this concave bowl and surrounded by designs that include things like laurel wreaths and Tudor roses. And the wonderful thing is that this has probably been in situ for 500 years. It was previously thought that this had come from the Holbein gate at Whitehall, but some of my former colleagues at Historic Royal Palaces have done lots of research on terracotta roundels and figured out that this has probably always been here, because it's in remarkably good condition, which is sort of congruent with it having been inside all this time. And why it's important is because Wolsey commissioned a number of terracotta roundels to hang at Hampton Court, and there are 10 of them on the outsides of the palace now. And they were from this craftsman called Giovanni de Mariano, who was an incredible Italian craftsman. and they are symbols of rule. So Hampton Court, quite amusingly, I think, on the outside they have Nero and Tiberius, as if that's a symbol of rule, not knowing that they did a very bad job. This is thought to be the Roman Emperor Probus, who introduced the vine to England. Yeah. So hence the play on words, and Tudors loved little puns like that. So it's amazing if we think that this was probably put here in the 1520s, and so again, when Henry came here in 1531, 1535, it's very, very possible that this emperor looked down on him as he's looking down on us.
That's fascinating. I mean, to my uneducated eye, it looks quite modern. Maybe that's just because it's been put in this white plaster surround, but it looks surprisingly modern to me.
And I think it's also partly because it's in such good nick. It's just that it's so sharp and so beautifully carved. But actually, it's from a craftsman in the 1520s.
And is that a fairly characteristic piece of Tudor work? Were they doing a lot of this sort of work, or was it very much limited to high status things like Hampton Court and here?
It's very high status. It's this sort of Italian Renaissance style of sculpture that was seen a lot at Nonsuch Palace, and so it's very impressive because it's so new. And by having it here, it's another way that Sands is saying he's connected to the people, the Wolseys. He's connected to people like Wolsey, and therefore can use craftsmen that Wolsey can afford to use. It's about wealth and ostentation, and it's a lovely piece of showing off, really.
Okay, so we've come to the chapel now, which is a lovely room, isn't it? And again, full of rich oak panelling. So what here is Tudor?
The panelling is, and you can spot that because of all the Tudor roses. It's beautifully carved. And you can see the sort of filigree work up there. And the ceiling as well has this sort of geometric pattern that's quite standard for a Tudor ceiling. And above all, though, the real attraction in here is the stained glass windows. These were commissioned by Sands in 1525. He had them made just down the road at Basingstoke. And they're portraits of members of the royal family. So on the left here, we've got Catherine of Aragon kneeling in prayer. And it's interesting, actually, because you can see her light colour hair. She had auburn hair, but, you know, we're so used to seeing her on film played by people with dark Spanish hair that we forget that. And in the middle, we've got Henry VIII. And on the right, we've got his sister, Margaret, who was Queen of Scotland. But the picture of Henry VIII is the most surprising one, because it's that young Henry we were talking about. It's Henry who's clean-shaven, and he's got long ginger hair.
Yeah.
It's a very surprising image of him. And I think what's interesting is that in the 1530s, when Henry visited a couple more times, he would have come here to pray, and he would have knelt before this. In 1531, when he was trying to get out of his marriage to Catherine of Aragon, and then in 1535 with Anne Boleyn, so that must have been a bit awkward as they stared after this picture of Catherine.
So what was Sands trying to do with this, other than just bow a sequence to the king? Was he trying to get any other messages across?
I think that's chiefly it. It's chiefly about stating his obedience to the king, again about demonstrating his wealth and his loyalty. It's a symbol of loyalty, so that when the king visits, he can be pleased at Sands.
Yeah.
Being a courtier is all about trying to be in such a position with the king that you are in his favour, and that you can ask things of him and speak to him the truth without displeasing him. At least that's what Castiglione says the perfect courtier ought to do.
How sure could we be that this is as it was? I mean, stained glass is a fairly fragile sort of thing. Do we know that this is actually exactly as it was? Has it been restored? Has it been recoloured, do you think? Or is this a fairly good reflection of what we might have been looking at back in the day?
I think it certainly has had some restoration, but I would imagine that these colours, you can see some places where it needs it as well, but we can see that these colours are very nice and bright, and that is likely to have been as it was. The Tudors really liked bright colours, in fact, quite often quite garish combinations.
Yeah.
And this was a way of displaying that high status, that this is a high status product and craftsmanship.
Okay. Perhaps we should just mention briefly, so that the ceiling, it's a very nice ceiling, isn't it? Quite colourful, geometric pattern. So you think that's got Tudor echoes there?
Yeah, it has Tudor written all over it. It's in blue and gold and red, and in fact many other ceilings in royal palaces might be decorated in a similar way. So this again is a sign of ostentation. Sands mixes with the best and he can host the best,
yeah,
and therefore he builds somewhere where they would be happy to be received.
But it's not quite as good as the one in Hampton Court, is it?
It's not quite as fine.
But would that have been deliberate? It's like, as you were talking about earlier, you don't want to go too far and have a better house than the king. Would that have been something that would have been in the mind of people like Sands and other courtiers?
I imagine it might be. I mean, Wolsey, of course, makes a great play about how his house is always the king's house, and he builds apartments at Hampton Court for Henry. And then when Henry takes a shine to it, Wolsey doesn't mind, in inverted commas, because, of course, it's always been the king's house. And perhaps you also don't want your house to look too good so that the king doesn't want to nick it.
OK, so we've come outside now, and we're walking along the path that's going to take us round to the front facade of the house. And as you said, there's the brickwork looks pretty Tudor to me. So what are we seeing here?
Well, we can see a beautiful house. And I mean, it's pretty big as it is now. You have to remember it was much, much bigger than this. One of the things that's characteristically Tudor about the brickwork is that it has these beautiful lozenge, diamond-shaped patterns picked out in black across it. And of course, we've got some good Tudor chimneys here as well. Although the windows are all now sash windows and all very modern by comparison to the Tudor period, this is still a spectacular and very beautiful Tudor-looking house.
The thing that's always struck me about Tudor houses is the brickwork. You can always feel that you can sort of immediately spot a Tudor house because of the colour of the bricks, if anything. Is my sensation correct there? Is that a good way to spot a Tudor house?
Yes, absolutely. Red brickwork, often interspersed with black brickwork. It's with these patterns picked out on it. That's characteristically Tudor. That's something to look out for. I mean, houses are built in brick and stone. I mean, even here we can see that the edges, the corners, are fixed with stone. And that's quite common in the Tudor period as well. But this is a fine mansion, and so he's used both.
Did they build well, the Tudors? Did they build to last? I mean, this house clearly has stood here for 500 years or so. I don't know how much work's been done to keep it standing here, but did they build well?
By some modern standards, there are things that they didn't do well, and of course we're always struck by the strange angles you find yourself at in Tudor houses, and not everything is quite perpendicular when it should be, or horizontal when it should be. But at the same time, yes, they did put a lot of money into these buildings, and a lot of them stand. Obviously, the cheaper Tudor housing that was thrown up didn't last. But these are built to stand here as a memorial to their owners.
Okay, so just to wrap up, I mean, we're still outside this lovely Tudor house. We've been inside. We've seen all sorts of lovely things. So just give us your reasons why people should come and visit Tudor heritage sites. What are they going to learn? How are they going to advance their knowledge of Tudor history by visiting places like this?
You can't really imagine what it might have been like to be a Tudor or to live in that period without going to Tudor houses. There you can evoke the sense of the past and, as we said earlier, walk in the footsteps of people that you know the names of and have a sense of what life might have been like for them. It's quite fun picking out the Tudor elements in a house and spotting things like the chimneys and the windows and the panelling on the walls, and knowing that Tudors walked and lived there. It's places where they loved and ate and prayed and died. And it's quite atmospheric and gives you a real sense of the past.
So that was Susanna Lipscombe. Her book, A Visitor's Companion to Tudor England, is published on the 15th of March by Ebury. You can read her feature on Tudor courtiers in the March issue of BBC History magazine. And remember, we have a slideshow of images from the Vine at historyextra.com/vine. If you want to see the Vine for yourself, you'll find details on the National Trust website at nationaltrust.org.uk/vine. Before our next interview, I'd like to announce that we're running a lecture series at the Tower of London over the spring and early summer. Our first event features military historian and TV presenter Saul David, alongside maritime archaeologist, historian and author Sam Willis. And they'll be discussing the subject of the Army or the Navy, which did more to put Britain on the map. The event takes place on Thursday the 19th of April, and you can find more information and buy a ticket on our website at historyextra.com/tower lecture. The Great Bed of Ware, an enormous Tudor piece of furniture, is one of the Victoria and Albert Museum's most popular attractions. Yet for the rest of this year, it's heading back to the small town in Hertfordshire whose name it bears, Ware. Dave Musgrove headed off to the V&A to take a look at the bed before it moves, in the company of Kate Hay, curator in the Department of Furniture, Textiles and Fashion at the museum.
Okay, so we stood in front of a large bed. So, Kate, if you could just give me a sense of what we're looking at here.
Well, it's a very large oak bed with carved posts, what we'd call a four-poster bed. It's 10 foot square, over 10 foot square, and more than 8 feet high. In fact, it's the largest Tudor bed to survive. No other beds of this size are known, and it's probable that no other beds of this size were ever made.
Hmm. Okay, and as you say, it's a very large bed, but it's also got some quite elaborate carvings on it. So clearly someone's invested a bit of money into creating this.
Yes, this bed was designed with great care. The strange thing about the Great Bed of Ware is that there's no documentary evidence at all about why it was made. So we're just assuming that it was made for one of the inns at Ware because it was known to be in an inn in 1596. But there's no documentary evidence about why it was made, but it was obviously made with great care because, as you can see, the posts are very, very finely turned and carved with complex floral canthus carvings on them. And the bedhead is particularly interesting with two arches containing marquetry of classical scenes with swans swimming in the centre. And these would have been made in London and, well, possibly the entire bed was made in London, we don't know. But they were rather special for the time, and they were made probably by German craftsmen in Southwark. And they're enclosed by a framework which incorporates figures symbolising, they're two male and one female figures with baskets of fruit on their heads. And we think that they symbolise fertility, which of course would be, you know, very appropriate for a large double bed of this kind. And also on the sides, there are figures of satyrs in profile, which obviously symbolise lust and, you know, sexual prowess and so on. So it's very, very carefully done, but it's not top quality of the sort that an aristocrat would have had. So we think it was made very carefully for an inn, but probably as an attraction to attract tourists to the inn.
I see, so it's not a high-status piece of furniture, then.
No, it was never intended as a very high-status piece of furniture, but nevertheless very carefully carved.
Okay. Just looking at the headboard there, it looks as if it's been in the wars a bit, so you haven't done much restoration to that.
No, a decision was taken to leave the bed in exactly the state we see it today. So parts of the marquetry is missing, but we thought that was more true to its origins. We didn't want to add anything. But what we found very interesting was when we analysed the paintwork on the figures, the three mythological figures with baskets of fruit on their head, on the headboard, they have traces of very bright paint, and analysis showed that this was original paint. So if you could imagine it in the 16th century, it would have looked quite gaudy with these three very brightly painted figures on the headboard. And the panels of marquetry would have been in pale and dark wood, so they would have looked very bright as well. So it wouldn't have looked as black as it does today. It would have looked very, very bright and cheerful and goes up.
So we can see the carvings, we can see the wooden frame, we can see the ceiling, which again is carved with nice patterns on it, and also...
Well, the testers actually quite interesting.
Okay.
Because if you compare The present day tester, which is very neatly carved and there's very few areas of damage on it.
To explain what a tester is.
The tester is what you might call a canopy across the top of the bed, and it's supported by these enormous oak posts at the corners and by the bed head at the back of the bed. But actually within that, that's like almost like a room setting in which you can draw the curtains around. Within that, there's still a bed frame with a separate set of legs and sides across which the bedding is piled up.
So
this is like a mini room, and you could draw the curtains and you would be screened. You would have privacy and warmth.
Right, I see.
Inside, yeah.
So the bed frame underneath the covering that you've got on now, that was just a fairly plain piece of timber, I presume, down there, isn't it?
Yes, they're very plain and utilitarian. And the side pieces have got holes drilled in them for stringing the hemp rope, which would have been the base of the bed.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a multiplicity of levels of bedding on the bed. First of all, you'd have your hemp rope strung across, which had to be very tight, of course. And then you'd have a bed mat made of plaited rush. And on top of that, we've put three different mattresses, one of wool, the next one of feathers, and the top one of down. And this is quite common. This was quite common in the 16th century. And when we redisplayed the bed for the British Galleries in 2001, we took enormous pains to go back to 16th century inventories and descriptions, and we looked at memorial brasses of beds and paintings to make sure that we could dress the bed as authentically as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the problems was there's no record of how the bed would have been hung. In other words, the hangings around the sides and the bedding originally. So we had to go back to basics. We acquired the bed just as a wooden frame.
Mm.
So all of the bedding that you see here, it has been hand woven and hand stitched and dyed with vegetable dyes according to the colours that were found most commonly in 16th century inventories. So we do think that when you look at the bed now, we've got as close as possible to what it would have looked like in the 16th century.
So you've gone for the Tudor look.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
And have you ever had the pleasure of lying on this bed? Is it comfortable?
No, we've had various requests for people to lie on it, but actually, because of its age and the fact that it was moved around from inn to inn at Ware,
yep.
It's actually quite unsteady, especially as at one stage it was cut down. If you look at the posts at the sides, they just stop. There should have been capitals on these side posts. It should have been another foot or two higher.
Oh, yeah.
But when it was moved, we think, from its original inn, it was made for the White Hart in Ware, when it was moved from that inn, the next inn, I think, had a lower ceiling, so they had to cut it down. And that's made the framework very unsteady. So we're very, very wary of anybody actually getting in the bed in case the tester falls down on them and kills them.
That would be unfortunate.
It would be terribly unfortunate. We have had requests,
right.
But we always have to refuse, unfortunately.
Because, I mean, it's quite domed, isn't it, in terms of the mats you've got on there. One would imagine that might not be that comfortable, but...
Well, no, it would have been incredibly soft. As you say, it's very, very high, and we know that there were steps. People had to have steps to climb up onto their beds in the Tudor period. And, in fact, when when the museum acquired this in the 1930s, it had extra rails put around the sides for people to step on, but we haven't displayed them in this display because we think that they were added later. I mean, maybe when I say later, maybe in the 18th century or the 19th century, but we took them off for this display because we felt that they weren't integral to the original bed.
Okay, so let's talk a bit about the history of the bed then, because as you said, you haven't got any documentary references to its construction. But you know it was around in the 16th century in Ware,
yeah,
which is north of London, a coaching town north of London. The next point you've mentioned is 1931 when you acquired it. So what do we know between those two
points? Those two dates? Well, as I said, the first mention was of the bed was by a German traveller who described a bed wide enough for four couples to sleep side by side, and that was in 1596. but the main... one of the principal reasons that the bed is now revered as a kind of icon of British history is that Shakespeare mentioned it in 1601 in his play Twelfth Night, when he wrote that Toby Belch would mentioned a sheet big enough for the bed of Ware. the bed atware, mm-hmm. I think. So this is the only piece of furniture mentioned by Shakespeare. Well, very few pieces were mentioned anyway, but this is the only piece of furniture mentioned by Shakespeare which still exists. And it's sort of an icon because it's like a direct link back to Shakespeare and back to the 16th century. So that's one of its main sort of claims to fame now.
So do we think that Shakespeare would actually have seen this then? Have we got any indication that he would have, or was he just working on, you know, that it was a widely known piece of furniture?
He might well have known it because it was a day's ride north of London, and anyone travelling north of London might well have stayed over in Ware. So it's entirely possible that he had seen it. Mm-hmm. But I think it was very very famous early on, so who knows whether he saw it. But after that, there were very many references. It became a kind of symbol of size, and Ben Jonson mentioned... But in fact, Ben Jonson, in his play Epicene or The Silent Woman, coined the phrase, the Great Bed of Ware, in 1609. And after that, it was mentioned by many, many travellers, and in bawdy tales, it cropped up. Mm-hmm. There was one report in an 18th century newspaper that 26 butchers and their wives had slept in the bed for a wager. I think that's pushing it slightly.
26 butchers and their wives.
And their wives, yes.
That would be a tight squeeze.
Yes, and actually, as time went on, I think people forgot the origin of it. And sometime in the 18th century, the date 1463 was written across the headboard, which is now been. I think that was on the across the tester. I think that was on the previous tester because it's gone now.
Right.
They obviously had no idea how old it was. It's only now, when we look back and we can fit it into the kind of history of Tudor furniture, that we know. No, its approximate date, which is 1590s.
Okay, so it stayed in Ware for most of its life, did it, or did it move?
Yes, it stayed in Ware until 1864, when the last innkeeper had to sell her property when her husband died, and at that point it was put up for auction, and we know that the museum authorities considered buying it, but in the 1860s, and the museum itself here was at a very early stage, it was only 10 years old, and it wasn't regarded as a very fine specimen. It was said of very mutilated, as it is. So a local hotel owner bought it and took it to Rye House in Hoddesdon, and it became one of his principal exhibits. And with the introduction of railways, it became one of the principal destinations on the Eastern Railway, and thousands of people went up to Rye House, where they had cricket grounds and, you know, roundabouts and things, but they also, and tea gardens, and he built a little house for the Great Bed of Ware, and it became one of his principal attractions. So it continued as a tourist attraction until the 1930s, when Rye House was closed.
Okay, just taking you back to the Tudor period for a second, why would a late Elizabethan inn in a small town north of London want to be a tourist attraction? Why would it want people to be coming to it?
Well, Ware had numerous inns, and I think it may have been a competition between the inns in the town of Ware. I mean, there were I don't know exactly how many, but there were all the way down the high street. There was inn after inn after inn, because that was the principal trade of the town. Mm-hmm. So possibly it was competition between innkeepers.
So you've said it's not a typical piece of Tudor furniture, I assume that all Tudor people were not sleeping in enormous beds like this.
No.
So
no.
Is it, you know, what do we know about Tudor beds? Were they much smaller than this and not so grand?
Yes, I mean, most Tudor furniture that survives is made of oak, because it's much the most sort of long-lived material, and so there's a kind of feeling that. Some people think all Tudor furniture was made of oak, but that's not the case. Very few pieces of Tudor furniture survive at all. Most people would not have very much furniture in their houses. In fact, their bed would have been one of their, you know, main pieces, and they might have had stools and maybe a trestle table, perhaps one armchair for the head of the family. Mm. But other than that, maybe they would have had a chest for their linen and any valuables that they had. It would have been the houses would have been very bare. So, this would have been a very splendid piece of furniture for that period.
So for the average man on the street coming to Ware, off the street and where this would have been, given the paucity of furniture lying around in their own houses, this would have been quite a surprising
they would have been,
thing.
They would have been very, very impressed by this piece. Amazed, I would have thought.
Yeah.
And one of the other interesting things is that people wanted to leave their mark on the bed of ware.
All right.
So you can see here.
Let's have a look.
On the post, this is one of the side posts of the bed, and people have inscribed layer upon layer of graffiti, what we would call carved graffiti. They've carved their initials and dates. I think the earliest date we found carved on the bed was 1696, but I think throughout its history, people have been carving their names. If they came and stayed in the bed, they would have time to carve their names. And you can also see on the top here a lot of red seals. Mm. That's sealing wax, where people would have dropped a piece of red wax and then pressed their signet ring into the seal. And that's another way.
Oh.
Yes, they're still there. They're indecipherable, unfortunately. We haven't been able to identify any of them, although we did try. But it's a way of people leaving their mark.
Yeah.
And funnily enough, there's a lion in the centre of the headboard, a carved lion over there, and someone has actually put a wax seal in the middle of his nose. So they had absolutely no respect.
It's a little disrespectful, yeah.
Yes, and you can see people have actually carved their initials on the marquetry in the reserves on the headboard as well.
Yeah. And that brings us to why we're talking about it today, because you're about to dismantle it once more and ship it back to Ware for a year to go on exhibition in their town museum. So,
yes.
So how are you going to do that? What's the process going to be?
Well, it requires a lot of manpower and zip-up frames to go up the sides, because the most difficult thing is the heaviest part of the bed is this canopy or tester.
Right.
And that has to be very carefully removed right at the very beginning. And that's got to be crated. It doesn't come apart. It's absolutely enormous.
So that's all. That's just one large piece.
And that is, I think, the difficulty with the bed is that each component part is in incredibly heavy. But the two most difficult pieces to manage are the tester and the headboard, which again is in one piece. So these have got to be crated, and that'll add to their the size, and it's going to be very difficult. We've had to work out which doors they can go through. They've got to go out of this door by the side here, down into the Raphael cartoon court, where they'll be crated. And then we've worked out a route, and we had to measure the front doors of the museum to make sure that the crates would actually go through the front doors of the museum.
Right.
So once the tester and the headboard have been taken away, then the rest of it comes apart relatively easily. But I mean, you can see that these corner posts are incredibly heavy. In fact, they're made out of four pieces. They were originally made out of four pieces of oak, which were joined together and turned. So each constituent part is very heavy in its own right.
Was it designed to be taken apart and dismantled? I mean, was it like flat pack furniture back
in
the day?
Well, that's an interesting question, because most historic beds were designed to be taken apart. They're normally fixed together by metal bolts that go through the constituent parts. So they are designed to be dismantled, but not very often.
Right. So presumably when it was first put up, it would have been taken into the inn and where, in a similar fashion to as it's coming out here.
Yes.
Someone would have erected it in situ in the bedroom, and then when it came to be taken down again, they would have done what you're about to do.
Oh, that's an interesting point, actually, because they must have had a lot of manpower and some kind of scaffolding going on around to lift the tester up, because you couldn't do it with ladders. You would have to have some form of scaffold in order to be strong enough to lift this, the weight of the oak.
What does something like this tell us about Tudor society, do you think? Does it give us a particular insight into life in the 16th century?
Yes, I think one thing it does tell us is they were not so different from us, that they liked a spectacle, they liked novelty, and they were intensely commercially competitive. There was an element of a tourism in that people would go to Ware to see the bed. So it tells us that actually human nature doesn't change that much.
That was Kate Hay from the Victoria and Albert Museum. The Bed of Ware has been dismantled and will be on display in Ware Museum from the 6th of April. And you can find out more about that at waremuseum.org.uk. We also have a slideshow of the bed being dismantled on our website at historyextra.com/bedofware. Well, that's all for this episode. We'll be back again next week when we'll be discussing religion and the FBI. Be sure not to miss it. In the meantime, don't forget to check out our website, historyextra.com, where you can find quizzes, image galleries, blogs, features, and details of our new Kindle edition. BBC History Magazine's weekly podcast is recorded in Bristol and produced by Dave Gibson.